everybody. Welcome. We have Julie Lithcott-Hames with us. I'm going to read you her short little bio. Author of New York Times bestseller, How to Raise an Adult, TED Talk on Overparenting, Top Talk of 2016, which I've seen and was amazing. Mom of two teens, partner of 30 years, former Stanford dean, former corporate lawyer, and your new book, Real American, was just released a few months ago. Thank you so much for being here, Julie. I'm excited to have this conversation with you.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
I have my one arm just for everybody that's looking because my dog is seeing squirrels and I just don't want him to freak out. But I think this is a great conversation to start. It's funny because we talk a lot about parenting and everyone wants to know how to parent. And there was like this paradigm shift to like, okay, we suck as parents. And now we're on the opposite end of the spectrum of over-parenting and trying to micromanage everything. But I just want to jump into the topic of like, how do we raise an adult when we are still trying to raise ourselves?
Well, you've loaded a lot into that first question. I guess I would say if we still think we're raising ourselves, then we need to go get help with that. And maybe that's therapy, maybe that's some skill building, but we have to be pretty clear about our own adult capabilities and capacities and obligations in order then to understand what the proper role is with our kids. Too often there's this intertwinedness. It's like my kid is me, like we're this little wrapped up loving ball and the love part is great. But if our ego is totally intertwined with what our kids do, the grade they got on their Spanish test, you know, how many goals they scored, whether they win this award, whether they get that internship or get, you know, admitted to that college, if our sense of self is all wrapped up in how our kids do, then we can't help but approach their childhood like this, like, how's it going? What are you doing? What are you up to? How can I help? Maybe I should help. Maybe I should do your homework. Maybe I should, you know, and all of a sudden it becomes us doing the work they need to do if there's any chance of them leading a healthy adult life.
Okay, so on page, I have my notes.
Okay.
I have totally scribbled all over this book.
Yay.
Page 240, how privilege leaves us lacking. And you talk about how, you know, we want to become better and give our children all of these things, but then there's an opposite end of the spectrum where our children aren't learning like basic human needs on work ethic and things like that. But can you talk a little bit about you were talking about the ironic twist around what happens when our children become actually overprivileged and we're, the opposite.
Yeah. So as you mentioned at the start, I was once a dean at Stanford. I was an administrator there for 14 years. I was the dean of freshmen from 2002 to 2012. And I stepped down in the summer of 2012. And while I was in that role, I had 1,700 freshmen every year. One thing that struck me as I became quite concerned about the number of students over the years who seemed to still be kind of held by their parents' hand, the students who weren't held by anybody, the students who really seemed to inhabit their own mind and body and make choices and solve problems on their own, not without consulting, but they had a sense of, I'm responsible. I will do this. I will try this. Those were students of mine who were from poor and working class backgrounds. And it makes sense because if you're overparenting, it's because you have time and often money on your hands such that you can invest in cultivating your kids every moment. Whereas kids who are from the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum have not been accustomed to relying on parents to be their handler, their concierge, the person to bring them the stuff they forgot, make choices for them, track their deadlines, fill out their forms, talk to their teachers. They've had to be more self-reliant. And so it is this beautiful irony because we think that a higher socioeconomic status brings all of the privilege. When what I discovered was, yeah, it does obviously brings a lot of privilege, but if you've been raised in a poorer environment and you've made it to college, chances are quite good that you've got a lot of skills, you know, that enable you to get out in the world and kind of do the stuff of life, do the things that are expected of an 18, 20, 22-year-old. So I call it this beautiful irony. So the question is, if we're raising kids amid relative privilege, I'm in my house here in Palo Alto in Silicon Valley. We're an upper middle class family. My task is, how do I instill in my kids this, that work ethic, that hunger, that drive, that impulse, you know, to go, 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 figure it out, try again, persevere, when quote unquote, they may not have to, you know, work around the house or have a part-time job for financial reasons. You know, it's, that's our conundrum.
So do you have any feedback when parents ask you that of like, my child's just not motivated, what do I do?
Well, the person I always point to when people say my child's not motivated is Jessica Leahy. She wrote The Gift of Failure. She's lives in New Hampshire and she's a middle school teacher and an author. And she basically, she writes this beautiful book about how kids have to be intrinsically motivated to work hard, to persevere, to achieve. We can't keep dangling these carrots in front of them or beating them with sticks. So around intrinsic motivation, it basically kids read Jessica Leahy's book, number one, but it kind of boils down to kids need to be autonomous. They need to be actually given more room so that they can kind of figure their way through it. It requires parents to be a little bit patient about outcomes because we're so concerned about every single quiz, every piece of homework. How can we let them just do it themselves? How can we not be on top of them? Well, the point is they've got to develop that motivation themselves to do the work, and that can take some time. But back to this work ethic thing, more broadly, there's a study, like I talk about in my TED Talk, one of the longest studies of humans ever conducted says that professional success in life comes from having done chores as a kid or having held a part-time job. And, you know, this is that, it's a lovely reminder of what really matters. Because those of us who are more socioeconomically privileged tend to raise our kids with a very full childhood, the right schools, a cage of enrichment, all those activities they have to do after school, their days are stacked. There's no time for chores. Mm-hmm. You know, we end up treating them, as Wendy Mogul, the author, has said, like benevolent dictators. You know, it's like we're serving their every need. We bring them their food. You know, as long as they're studying or they're doing their activities, we're happy. Well, that means we're doing the chores or we're hiring somebody else to come into our house and do them. And our kid is deprived of learning that work ethic that comes from having to take out the garbage, do the recycling, do the dishwasher, do the laundry, do the vacuuming and the sweeping, whatever it is. So chores, your original question was, so how do we get kids to do this? You know, giving kids a set of expectations in the home from young about how they will contribute to making the place better for all of us, you know, teaches them a work ethic, teaches them to roll up their sleeves and pitch in and don't just act as if you're some prince or princess who's going to be served by others for the rest of your life.
Yeah. And I love how, I don't know where in the book, but I remember reading it and I have three boys. I'm like, oh, you know, when they have like birthdays and you're like, dang it. You've got to like, in your brain, you got to change the number. You're like this. So 13, 8, and 5. And I was looking, I'm like, okay, yeah, you can do that. You can do that. And so it was funny, Julie, because something that my 5-year-old would resist because he's the youngest. I'm like, no, you are very, very capable of doing this. But it's almost like permission, right? Permission, because you're too busy trying to, like you said, make their lives full or do this or do that. That you forget, like you can wipe your own ass. You should be able to wipe your own ass by now.
Well, I guess we know we're not on radio.
Oh, the podcast is explicit. So yes, I see.
Got you, Heather. I'm always watching my language when I'm interviewed by people, but thanks for letting me know I can take the muzzle off.
Yeah, you can take the muzzle off.
Yeah, they need to wipe their own ass. And that's kind of really poignantly the point, which is one day, we'll be dead. All right. Can I just say that? Right. One day we'll be dead. The parents we are, we will be gone. And please let us not wait until, let our children not be bewildered when we're dead, because we have failed to teach them how to do anything on their own. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's what's happening to young adults. They arrive at young adulthood. They've had a manicured, perfected childhood, you know, lovingly planned for them by moms and dads with the best of intentions. And then they have to hashtag adult and they don't know how to do the basic things to get through a day. Wake yourself up. You don't need your parents to wake you up. Make yourself food. You don't need someone else to do that. Personal hygiene, getting dressed, keeping track of your belongings, knowing what your obligations are and how to meet them, your deadlines, the tasks you have to do, how to interact with strangers. One of the points I make is this manicured childhood, this overprotected childhood comes with a catchphrase, don't talk to strangers. Well, guess what? When they leave our homes, their entire life is full of strangers. The skill is, how do you discern the one creepy stranger from the vast majority of humans who are perfectly fine? That's what we're supposed to teach our kids, because they got to go out and interact with strangers for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and really trust that intuition and that gut, right? Of like, yeah, this is not a good situation.
That's right. They have to develop that intuition.
So you mentioned something about one day we're going to die. And part of the reason why I do what I do is because I almost died 4 years ago. I had stage 4 cancer.
Oh my gosh, and Heather. Before, I had no idea. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
But before I got sick, I had to go through treatment. I had, you know, regardless, I'm not going to, in a nutshell, I had this belief that nobody can take care of my children better than I can. And right. I was forced to. They're still alive today and they eat more mac and cheese than they've ever eaten in their entire life. And they're okay. They're okay, right?
Yeah.
And it blew my mind. And I'm so grateful that I had that opportunity to go, you know what? You tried to hustle and do everything for everybody and it almost killed you to the point where it's okay. You know, your children can eat macaroni and cheese sometimes if other people are taking care of them. It's okay. And I think it's gotten to this extreme of, you know, women just crying themselves to sleep at night and men and trying to figure it out and do it all.
I got to just jump in there and say, thank you for sharing that. But also, often that's what it takes. Mm-hmm. Often people get super clear when there is a significant health issue in the family or a tragedy or something, you know, something really shifts us at the level of our foundation, right? You develop cancer. All of a sudden, everything has to change. And that becomes the more important thing. And then you realize, okay, so I can't make the organic gluten-free bagels for my kid's soccer team anymore. Oh no, I'm a terrible parent. Yeah. You know, you might have thought, now you're like, guess what? That doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. Our priorities get reshuffled and we realize what matters. And I think the challenge is, can we not learn these lessons before the cancer hits, before the person dies, before we lose our jobs? You know, let's not wait for the big tragic moment to clarify for us what really matters. Let's try to make that shift now. You know, your kids benefit by having to do a little bit more for themselves, by being able to trust in other people, not just their mom, not just their dad. You know, I mean, these are sort of the life lessons that have to be learned, and better that they be learned young than that, you know, when they're 25 and 30 and they finally realize, oh my gosh, you know, I've got to learn how to make macaroni and cheese.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Well, now you can, oh God, I didn't want to get a start on that topic. okay. I want to know what is your, you know, in the essence of trying and talking about this, of it needing to get to a point, why can't we learn these lessons before something happens? But what has inspired you to write these books, How to Raise an Adult? And I'm curious if you're finding an overlap in your conversations with How to Raise an Adult and The Real American.
Okay. So what is the overlap? What makes me write these books? I'm 50. I just turned 50. So I've lived a lot of life. I hope there's a lot more to come. I care about humans. I'm like many people, I'm very interested in helping other humans on their path. I'm interested in the journey. I believe in all of us. And so these two books, one is about overparenting, How to Raise an Adult. My new book that you mentioned, Real American, is a memoir on race, my experience as an African-American biracial person in America. I think what they have in common is I'm interested in what gets in the way of humans thriving. Mm-hmm. And so this overparenting, you know, the overprotection and fierce direction, like you will be this, I will always know where you are and hold on to you, you know, and I'll be your concierge and hold your hand all the time. All of that may be lovingly intended, but it really deprives a young person of developing a sense of self, so they can't actually make their own way. Yeah. It's an impediment to their thriving. Well, racism and bias and prejudice is an impediment to humans thriving often. And so my memoir on race is kind of how I made my way through that, through those experiences, to finally be a person who could be herself regardless of how some folks might view members of my community. So that's what they have in common. Ultimately, I'm interested in humans thriving, you know, unfettered, unimpeded by other people's judgment. And so that's why I've written these books, and I'm going to be writing more books. I'm loving writing books.
Yeah, I'm just getting started in the book world, and cool. I love it. But part of it is creativity. Part of it is tapping into who you are as a human being. And what I really enjoy talking about women, especially who have children, is this concept of who we need to be as mothers, right? The overparenting, we're talking about that. Why do you think it's, what, okay, my question for you is going down this path, real American, how to raise an adult, what has that given you as a mother? What have your children observed from you from expressing the side of yourself?
I think they've seen me take a really big detour. People might have seen it as a detour when I left Stanford, decided to go back to school to get my MFA in writing to try to become someone who could write books worth reading. You know, there was a lot of rhetoric around, wow, that's a brave choice, you know, and I think by brave, people were meaning like stupid, uninformed, like, what are you doing, you know, and my kids watched me do that and watched me go through that, watched me succeed at that, watched me get a book deal, watched me promote a book, watch that book do well, you know, but they also saw me come home with my struggles, you know, like, wow, that was a really hard talk tonight, you know, here's why. Wow, this didn't go well. Ugh, I got to figure this out. So I think I've been modeling for them how a human charts a professional path and, you know, the effort that has to go in, the downsides, the frustrations, but also the joys. We are our kids' best role models. And so, you know, I don't want my kids to just see the shiny bits that are successful in my life. I want them to see how I pick myself back up when something shitty has happened. And, you know, I think they've seen that as well. And the great part about how to raise an adult is if you go to one of my book talks, you know that I tell stories on myself. I'm not this like former dean who's like, you parents, you need to stop overparenting. You know, I was once that way, but years ago I became this like, oh shit, I'm overparenting. I got my own kids and I'm doing the same thing that will result in a college student who's overparented. I got to turn things around. And I tell stories in my book talks about myself that move me to tears and move my audience to tears. These are stories about how I woke up and basically saw what I was doing to my own kids. And my kids know I'm telling those stories. And I think they're proud of me for the growth that I've experienced. And of course, they're happy and relieved that I'm a little bit less, you know, of an overparent now because I've become so aware of the issue.
Would you, I don't remember what story it is, but would you tell, because I heard you speak at Dr. Shefali's Evolve conference.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a story about your son in Spanish. Mm. Would you be able to tell that story? Because I think it really was a visual for parents. They would be able to get that.
Well, it's a long story. I'll try to condense it for our purposes here. So here we are in Palo Alto, California. My kids attend a very rigorous public high school, one of the best in the land, quote unquote, according to test scores, et cetera. So really rigorous curriculum. My son, Sawyer, was 15 and a sophomore. It was October, and he was doing 5 hours of homework a night, which seemed excessive to us. Very bright kid, intellectually curious. School had always been easy. And here he is with 5 hours of homework. And it wasn't even the junior year, which we've all kind of agreed is going to be hell. This was only fall semester, sophomore year. And he seemed to be sort of trying to keep his head above water, you know, as the homework stacked up. This kid doesn't do any sports or activities. My son reads books. Look at all these books like we have in our house. We have books everywhere. And he just reads. He reads for pleasure. He's a thinker. And always, you know, as a kid that took books on play dates, in case the play date didn't work out, you know, he'd have a book and, you know, put books in the pockets of his cargo shorts to go to high school, you know, just books. Anyway, no time to read is my point because the homework was just so much. Spanish 3, honors chem, algebra 2, trig, which is the fast lane, which was going to lead to the right calculus and the intergalactic math, you know, in college. Fancy English class, fancy history class, a couple other classes. I can't remember the name, but a really rigorous schedule. And just doesn't seem to have time for anything but homework. Also has ADD, which means things are challenging for him. But to date, he'd been able to manage it. So we try to help our son break all of this work down into, you know, break the large projects into smaller bits, teach him time management, teach him how to advocate for himself with teachers. But the homework doesn't let up. Into the first weekend of this, it goes. He's working Saturday and Sunday still. You know, his eyes are starting to be red in the mornings. He's not bringing a book to breakfast anymore. Fully into week two, this goes, and he's getting weary. And he's just lost that energy that I think of as like my son.
We're going to tell stories together. I'm going to put you on mute. Keep going. I'm grabbing my dog because he likes cats.
Okay. Into week three, this goes. The homework is not letting up, and we know he's got to not only take all these classes, but do well in them if he's going to kind of get to the right class junior year and get to the right college, you know, a couple years later. But the homework load was crushing the life out of my kid. And after 3 weeks of this, I could tell that something had to change. He was doing well in all the classes. It's just that the workload was too high. And again, it wasn't like he was also doing sports and activities. Just to get through all the homework every day was too much. So my husband and I decided we needed to ask him if he wanted to drop a class. By this point, I realized he was barely even doing his own Spanish homework. Google Translate was doing it for him. He was always leaving it for last in the stack of homework. And he'd put in the English and it would tell him the Spanish answer and he'd write it down. So, you know, cheating or, you know, at best, not learning. And I was really worried that this was not sustainable for us or for him. And I say us because we were very wrapped up in, you know, we've got this homework and we've got to do this. And that's part of the overparenting lexicon. We always say we when we mean our son or daughter. So we decided to ask him if he needed to drop a class because we didn't think he could survive the semester, let alone the remainder of sophomore year, let alone the hellish junior year, which was to come. And so at about midnight one night, when he'd finally finished his homework and was in bed, I went up to his room to talk to him about dropping a class. And I knocked on the door. He invited me in. He was already in bed, just had gone to bed. And he was still sleeping in the Harry Potter loft his daddy built for him when he was a little boy, sleeping in a Harry Potter themed room with all of the dungeon-like stuff on the walls and the place for the wand and the broomstick and the cloak. And I climbed the steps to his loft and I looked down at Sawyer and I say, "Sweetheart, Dad and I are so impressed with how hard you're working, you know, and you're doing well, and we're proud of you. But it looks like it's too much, honey. You don't even have time to read a book anymore. And that's who you are. You're not even reading for pleasure. Do you think you might need to drop a class?" And my boy looks up at me and says, "Can I? Don't you guys want me to do all of this? Don't I have to? Mom, isn't it what'll make you proud?" And I knew, like, we bought this house here so you could go to that school, so you could take all those classes, so you could do really well in them and get to the right college. But I didn't say any of that. I just looked at my precious child and I said, "Sweetheart, in some theoretical universe, we wanted you to have access to all these classes, all of this opportunity. But you know what? What matters more than any of that is you, and you're struggling and you might even be suffering. Do you think you might need to drop a class?" And he said, "I'll think about it." And his little eyes brightened just a little bit, just being seen in his struggle helped. And he came down for breakfast the next day and he said, "Mom," he had a book with him under his arm, you know, finally got a book. And he said, "Mom, I think I might need to drop a class. And I think it might need to be Spanish." And I laughed and I said, "Yeah, I thought Spanish was problematic." Anyway, he dropped Spanish and we got our kid back and he had more room to study for the classes he really loved, but it also meant shutting some doors on some colleges that would demand that he have 3 years of a language. And we decided on that evening to care about our son more than we cared about college admission to those places. Mm-hmm. And it was terrifying and it was such a relief when we finally kind of made that leap. And I went from talking the talk in my book that I was writing, How to Raise an Adult, I was writing it at the time, to walking the walk and being able to see my son for who he was and accept the limitations and be delighted about helping him become his best self rather than some perfect ideal kid I had may have had in my mind.
I love this. I love that story and I love the emotion you bring to it and how it can, it's so real and everybody, oh Jesus, Doug, everybody, he sees a squirrel and he's going for it.
how everybody can relate with it because it's so relatable. And I think this is a beautiful conversation to have that, you know, how far is too far when we are really want the best for our children, but is it really the best for our children?
Listen to this. Your dog. Well, you know, Sawyer's story has a really happy ending. First of all, it was happy in that moment. You know, he began to, you know, be reanimated with intellectual curiosity about the classes he was in and with the workload more manageable, you know, he continued to thrive. When it came time to apply to college, he applied to about 13 places, was rejected from half. You know, he's a strong student with strong test scores, but again, no sports, no activities, try impressing a college these days with that. You know, he just reads and thinks, you know, which ought to be very impressive, but these days, no, 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 you're supposed to bring all of that stuff on your childhood resume. So he wants a PhD in biology, he thinks. And so we together found a list of schools that whose graduates go on to get PhDs in the natural sciences. And there are some big universities on that list. The top 10 list includes MIT and Caltech, but also about 7 or 8 small liberal arts colleges that most people, quote unquote, haven't heard of, like Oberlin in Ohio, Swarthmore in Pennsylvania, Kalamazoo College in Michigan, Reed College in Portland, Oregon. And so he applied to a bunch of those schools. Well, he got rejected from half the schools he applied to and accepted at the others and whittled it down to about 4. When Reed College accepted him, they sent him a book in the mail. They sent him, we have it here somewhere. Well, I can't find it. They sent him a copy of the Iliad. And to send my child a book in the mail when they admitted him, it just brought me to tears. Like it was a letter with confetti and then a book. And I was like, they see my kid for who he is. They know that my kid wants that book. My kid will read that book. You know, my kid is not doing school. My kid is somebody who reads and thinks passionately. And it was like they were beckoning him saying, hey, we see you, Sawyer. We know that this is who you are and what you like. Come be with us. We got people like you here. And he indeed enrolled at Reed this fall and found his people. Within hours, he had made friends. You know, he has magnificent friends. And I've just lost my screen. Anyway, so it's okay. It has been a marvelous, marvelous story.
I love this.
A good ending, yeah.
So in all of this, wrapping it up, how to raise an adult from over-parenting to just this messed up journey of, am I enough? Am I doing enough? Do I need to try harder? What do you say to that woman who's listening going, I just feel like I'm failing or I'm not enough or where do I start? I can't get rid of these thoughts.
Therapy and great podcasts. I mean, here's the thing. For too many of us women, our kids' performance in school, on the playing field, in life, feels like it's our report card. You know, I'm worthy, I'm smart, I'm accomplished. If I can show you what my kid has done, well, that's really messed up. And we have to untangle ourselves from that. And therapy is a great place to do that. In other words, your kid's achievements have nothing to do with you, okay? They are theirs. Their failures are theirs. Yeah, we're supposed to be making sure they know their manners and they can work hard and they can be kind to other people. You know, teach your kids those things. Insist on those things. But their outcomes, their grades, that's them. You know, your measure of your own self has to come from within you. I am worthy. I am lovable. I matter. We all need to feel that inside of us. We can't look to our children to make us feel better about ourselves. So therapy, therapy, therapy. You know, what I say jokingly when I'm out giving talks for how to raise an adult is get a life. Maybe your kid can get one too. You know, all of this hovering that we do deprives our kids of the chance to live their own glorious life. It's anxiety producing for everybody when we're so worried about every little detail in their lives. So a breather, a deep breath, a bit of room, you know, a bit of distance, you know, okay, I don't have to know where my kid is at every moment. Let's stop saying, oh no, Heather, I can't join you for that really awesome cocktail party you're throwing because we have a midterm tomorrow. Right. No, you don't have a midterm tomorrow. Your kid does. You know, stop telling your kid that they're incompetent. you know, by having to hover over them and manage them through their homework and their test prep. You're not taking algebra. Your kid is. Mm-hmm. You go live your adult life. Let your kid be an eighth grader. You know, you'll both discover, you know, what a pleasure it is to not, you know, be all up on top of each other all the time.
I love that.
I'm like, yep. So you have a little bit of a life right now.
Mm.
Where are you? What are you doing? I was on your website and you have your book tour. Do you have the book in front of you, The Real American? Obviously, if it's on the podcast, they're not going to be able to see it.
Yes, I do. But for those watching on video, here's my book, Real American. That's little old me at about 15 months of age, looking angry. I call it my Frederick Douglass look. But that little girl is saying like, oh, hell no. Or I want this, or I'm perplexed, or I'm pissed. So I have been on book tour. It came out early October. I've been around the country, been really fortunate to go to great bookstores all around the country. I go out for one final push at the end of January. I'll be in Boston, sort of Cambridge, Boston, Provincetown, Natick, Atlanta, New Milford, Connecticut, and then Cleveland. So it's one final push. And then I start to write the sequel to How to Raise an Adult, tentatively called How to Be an Adult, which is for all those 20 and 30 somethings trying to figure out how to hashtag adult. I'm going to try to pass on some Gen X wisdom to generations Y and Z, and pretty excited about that.
That's exciting. I can't wait to read that one too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Julie, so much. So people can find your book all over the place, bookstores, online.
Absolutely. And my website is julielifcotthames.com. So my name, my full name without the hyphen, julielifcotthames.com. You can read about my books there, my tour schedule, see some of my videos, my TED talk, etc. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. The closest you'll be to me is Cleveland, which is about 2 hours away. I'm in Ontario, so I'm in Canada.
You just said a boat. You just gave it away by saying
boat?
A boat. It's about 2.5 hours away.
Eh? Thank you so much, Julie.
Thanks, Heather. Take care.
I sometimes joke that I wish I taught people how to make green smoothies for a living. But I know I'm doing that because I'm trying to run away from what brings me joy. And what brings me joy is helping women and men, families in general, and children feel alive. And sometimes that journey to feeling alive is painful. It's emotionally uncomfortable, and it's not always easy. This is why I created the Aligned Life Quiz. So if you're tired of being tired, you want to stop just surviving, and you want to find out exactly where to focus and access realistic tools to confidently manage your energy, emotions, and impact, you can head on over to Heather Chauvin, chauvin.com/lifequiz. It takes you 2 minutes and it's going to show you, I call them internal leadership skills. Where do you need to focus your energy and attention for the quickest results? And also, which phase are you living in? So head on over to heatherchauvin.com/lifequiz to take the Aligned Life Quiz right now. If you're ready to stop just surviving and you want to start thriving, but you don't know how to manage it all, go there. It will take you 2 minutes and it will change your life. I also, on the inside, show you which podcast episodes to listen to based on your quiz results. heatherchauvin.com/lifequiz.